semantic web folks who may not believe in upper ontologies in general. Next. What we want to do is just briefly go through our points of agreement as we've discussed in very long time online. We desire semantic interoperability. We agree that a taxonomy is not enough, that axioms are an indispensable part of creating semantic interoperability. Also, we've agreed to disagree, if you will, on the best way to achieve interoperability. So one of the things that we're going to talk about, hopefully the individuals who are speaking today will talk about their particular upper ontologies and their notions of alignment, interoperability, mapping, subset, etc. And we agree that the dialogue on making upper ontologies interoperable will help improve existing upper ontologies. These are probably uncontroversial. Next slide. The opportunities and challenges that we have, and these are by no means exhaustive list. Modularity, how do we achieve it? Right. We have listed Lattice, others have proposed maybe a library or registry of theories, logical theories, ontologies as logical theories. We've had some contention between the compatibility of 3D versus 4D. There may be other issues involved. How do we put these together? One way is perhaps by mapping. Now, what does that mean, between the terms or the axioms of the individual upper ontologies? Term-to-term maps, bridging axioms between the two ontologies that you want to align or connect. Do we want to find consistent common interpretations or interpretation subsets? Again, do we want a reference library or possibly a registry of upper ontologies? Do we want to express our upper ontologies in a common language, a dialect of common logic, for example? This emerging IKL language from ICRIS, interoperable knowledge language. Do we want to identify an interesting or intersecting subset of terms and axioms of the relevant upper ontologies? Do we want to really focus also on areas of agreement and where perhaps agreement is easy in particular, especially if we move this forward, and then also identify gaps or difficulties in the areas where we don't agree and we don't expect we'll have agreement anytime soon. So what are some of the barriers to agreement? What assumptions do we make individually that are insurmountable or potentially insurmountable? Can we make those explicit? Do we have criteria for evaluating ontologies, including application-based criteria, especially upper ontologies? It's sometimes difficult to understand how applications would actually use these directly. We have all intuitions and experience, but they may not necessarily be in common. We also want, I think, to eventually understand the criteria for evaluating ontologies and perhaps even think ahead towards eventual certification. Next slide. And finally, the next step. So we went through points of agreement, things that we want to, problems and issues, challenges, opportunities we want to focus on today, in the course of today in particular, but it also applies to tomorrow, it's just the public section tomorrow. Potential next steps. What do we do after this summit, right? We know we're going to have this joint communique. This is the beginning. That's the beginning. It's not the end, right? And what we want to do is gather somehow the energy to sustain this interoperation, if you will, between the various custodians and, of course, the key participants through the future. So do we want to establish a consortium or a working group affiliated or unaffiliated with an existing standards group? NCOR, for example, National Center for Oncological Research, the European Center, the new Japanese Center. Do we want some sort of group that responds to all those and affiliated with all of those? And what we want to do is identify, or at least begin, some of the pairs of upper ontology and content elements across upper ontologies where alignment might be particularly important and maybe easier initially, and build on that. The whole point is we want to build on what today begins. And then, of course, for the issues in the previous slide, and also the next steps, do we want to seek joint funding to address these? Because we know that without funding, the odds are that folks will be diverted by their funded projects. Are there any other issues people are interested in exploring or bringing up real briefly right now before we switch to the speakers?
Well, I'd like to make a comment. Sure. Just that what I'm looking for here is this combination of technical agreement and alignment, intention, if you like, even if we don't achieve specific technical conclusions here, for the purposes of, can you all hear me on the phone as well? Yeah?
Anybody out there on the phone?
Is the phone connected?
Is the phone still here? Connected?
Yes, I'm there. Yeah.
Okay, so you're hearing. Okay, good. Is also to get send a message both to the standards communities and to the marketplace that there is now at least awareness and intention to try and create some bridges between some of these upper ontologies. So from a standards perspective, which is where I work, I know that will be very valuable for committees who are considering whether or not they should start using some of these ontology tools and, you know, representations. And I would have to believe in the marketplace there are also companies who are wondering whether they should be investing in this kind of thing. And if they see no appearance of migration toward bridges, I'm being careful trying to say not necessarily a single ontology, but means to get information between them. I think some companies are holding back until they see something like that. So I'm just as interested in the message we're sending and sort of the marketing side of this meeting, which is Wednesday afternoon, as I am in achieving any technical conclusions today. I think both of those are very important. So that's just my own perspective. Okay.
Pat Cassidy, my own personal perspective as I would call myself something of a prospective user in a sense, and as a work person, a minor to a certain extent involves advising government agencies about problems which, no matter how they occur, is ultimately resolved into interoperability questions. And my appreciation of the issue is that the best way to resolve it is through the use of the common ontologies. But I do not advise the agency at this point to take any particular common ontology to use because the question is really that any one is going to go to origin from the dominant ontology. When it is used, especially when it is used in the federal government, then any investment at this time could ultimately be replaced. What I'm looking for this meeting is to see if there's any indication, just for example, if several of the existing upper ontologies were to decide to try to find commonalities, perhaps a common subset or some other mechanism, that might be enough of an indicator that these system and growing usage by making people to make a decision.
Okay.
Bill?
Yes.
I know many, but not all the people.
Oh, yeah. We have, we're late anyway, so we have a couple minutes. What I'd like to do is, maybe we should all go around and just say who we are.
Or we could do that during kind of a break. I don't know.
Could we do it now?
I think we should do it now.
Okay, let's do it now. Yeah. I'm Leo Overs from Myers.
I'm Steve Ray from NIST.
I'm Nicola Bonino from Italian National Research Council.
Chris Wilkie from IBM Research.
Matthew West from the show.
I'm about to go down the hill and down.
Alan Clark.
I was just looking to see if we
have a... Pat Cassidy, Peter Young from CIN3.
Connor Bach from NIST.
Michael Greger, University of Toronto.
Michael Huschel, Boeing Company.
Doug Bennett, Frank Quark.
Steve Giovannini, Department of Defense.
And John Walker, Department of Defense.
And how about the phone people? We just have to self-organize here a little bit.
Folks on the phone, do you want to say your name and affiliation?
This is Barry Smith, University of Buffalo.
Anyone else?
Jim Schoening, IEEE. I'll be there about noon.
Okay.
John Bateman, University of Bremen. Jim Lopakowski, University of Bremen.
Is
that everyone on the phone?
Hannah Rubin, University of Maryland, and Cindy.
Any remainder, folks?
Okay.
Our first speaker, Doug Bennett.
Thanks, Leo.
Everyone knows Doug. So.
Thanks, Leo. For those of you on the phone, if you refresh your web page, my slides will magically be there. I'm giving several talks, little tiny talks here and there, over the next several days. So, in a way, this is the residue of those. So, in a way, it's kind of an odd introduction. This is the material which didn't fit in any of the other talks. These are things which, basically, I'm willing and happy and want to say to you guys, but not necessarily to the public. And so, to first order, I agree with communique, which is something I will say to the public. And at the very end, if I actually have any time at the end, I'll tell you a little bit about OpenSite and ResearchSite. But in the middle, like for the next 14 and a quarter minutes, I'm actually going to say a bunch of things which may surprise or annoy several of you. And I've actually like highlighted the things which I expect will get the most controversy, and will tell me things like whether Chris is paying attention or anything like that. Basically, let me go through very briefly how and why I was forced into this. Or by this, I don't mean this meeting, I mean this field. Basically, what happened was I've been always interested, certainly for the last 30 or 40 years, I've been interested in amplifying human beings mentally, in producing devices which will enable us to think better and more productively, misunderstand each other less, do more things in parallel, and so on. The reality throughout the late 60s when I started getting involved and all through the 1970s and the early 80s was that we kept smacking our nose into the same brick wall over and over and over again in different subfields of artificial intelligence. That was basically what you might think of as the brittleness bottleneck, the idea that without a large ontology, without a large amount of world knowledge, consensus reality knowledge, we just were going to be limited to having the veneer of intelligence, the veneer of understanding, the veneer of success, without actually amplifying human beings. So the first controversial statement I'm going to make is, based on doing this for about 30 years, one of the reasons why I almost didn't come to this meeting is that the lesson I learned from all that is that To first order, upper ontology pretty much impacts only the efficiency of your overall system, the efficiency of the vocabulary of the axioms and of cross-ontology mapping axioms. So when I say that it impacts things like the efficiency of the vocabulary, I mean things like, well, you were just talking about the Japanese effort. So one of the reasons that I was able to get funding in 1983 for this work was the American fear of the Japanese fifth-generation computing effort. American companies were scared to death that Japan was going to make good on its claim to do in the software industry what it had already done in automotive and consumer electronics. It took about 10 or 12 years until American companies became more afraid of mutual fund managers than the Japanese. But, you know, maybe it's changing back, but that would be good. But in any case, I had the pleasure of dealing with Uchida and a bunch of other folks from the Electronic Dictionary Research Project and several other parts of the fifth generation effort. And much to my surprise, their upper ontology was very different from the one we were building in Austin, Texas. Namely, their top-level split, conceptually, was among things that had souls and things that didn't have souls. And if you actually looked into that a little bit more detail, it was even stranger from our Western point of view, because large trees had souls, but small trees didn't. And you know, things like that, like, holy shit, what the hell's going on with this? And yet, you could deal with these people as if they were sane, because they knew, you know, like, if you have soup, you should eat it well, I put that example. But, you know, they knew things like, how to deal with physical objects in the world. They understood about causality and time, and they understood like all the things I did, and yet their upper ontology, from my point of view, was all screwed up. So then as you begin to look at their next level down and the next level down and the next level down, you realize that all the weirdnesses up near the very top, which reflected their religious or cultural biases and so on, just like ours reflect our biases and so on. All that was really doing was, it was making a little bit more work for them here and there at three or four or five levels down from thing in their ontology. For instance, if you're all familiar, I'm sure, with brew and bleen. Brew is something which is, let's say, green during the daytime and blue at night, and so on. So if you actually think of colors, divide up colors into things like brew and bleen is sort of the opposite, and so on, then yes, you can still talk about things in the world. It's just you have to have more terms and more complicated terms, and so on. Same thing if you have a set of reification axioms that basically force you to compound things like the government of France in 1985 as Israel believed it to be, or something like that. If you're not careful, you have an explosion of terms where you should be faceting or factoring and having a smaller number of terms. All it would really affect is how complicated the terms are, how many terms there are, and so on. And the same thing about the axioms. So if you have things like brew and bleen, then you have to have an axiom which is most things in the natural world are brew by day and bleen at night, except the ones which are bleen by day and brew by night, and so on. And if you have green and blue instead of brew and bleen, you don't need that axiom. I could give you examples where if you have ambiguous terms, like is related to, here I'm using this as a joke because the Smurfs are a cartoon that use the word Smurf for pretty much any noun, verb, adjective, relationship, predicate, anything you might want. So if you have things like is related to, or if you conflate different neurological predicates like element of and subset of and physical part of and so on, if you just have one vague part relationship and so on, then again, you're going to have, in this case, more ambiguous axioms, and you're going to have more axioms, in effect, to disambiguate them, and so on. So that's what I mean when I say that, to me, the upper ontology choice, and really not just upper ontology, but ontology choice, period, all the way down, to first order affects efficiency. And really, the representation choice you make affects efficiency. And so we can make the same statement about, do you represent things in English sentences? Do you represent things as a series of N equations and N unknowns? Do you represent things in propositional logic and first order logic and higher order logic and so on? So yes, we have an upper ontology. No, I'm not going to explain it or defend it or care about it. I really don't care. If any of you care, what the hell? We'll use your upper ontology. It just doesn't matter. If the upper ontology mostly just impacts efficiency, where is the power in all this? Where is the effort worth putting in? And from my point of view, the effort is not worth putting in near the bottom, which is where most people put in effort. This is where, for the last four decades, expert system builders and knowledge-based system builders have been stuffing detailed knowledge into the heads of their programs. And it's not up at the very top, which is where, for the last four millennia, philosophers have been worrying about the meaning of primary categories ever since, I guess, Aristotle, or I guess before Aristotle. You know, what is wetness? What is fire? What is goodness? But somewhere in the middle, like vehicles slow down in bad weather, and your visibility goes down, and all the travel along pathways, and that kind of stuff in the middle, that's where, from my point of view, there is an enormous amount to do. There's a lot of useful leverage that we can get out of doing that kind of ontologizing work. So from my point of view, the upper level really just needs to be not terrible. As long as it's not terrible, you don't need to worry too much about it. The lower levels, everybody else will worry about as they build their specific systems. But if they only worry about the lower levels, then they're cutting ontological corners because their particular task enables them to say, oh, for this task, I can simplify time in the following way. For this task, I can assume all objects are point objects, and so on. Okay. So the intermediate level is the locus of power. So from my point of view, that means we need to share the upper and intermediate levels, or else we aren't really going to be sharing ontologies at all. We'll just be having the veneer of sharing ontologies. So you can think of the history of this as a progression of one false peak after another, like people saying, we'll agree on ASCII, now we can get electronic data interchange, and now we can have our systems all share their knowledge because we've agreed on an ASCII character set, or whatever, and slowly go down to HTML. Most of the world is sort of at this level of XML tag vocabularies being shared and so on, whereas most of the few in the room would agree that that's just another false peak. The semantic web, as it's promulgated, is really just another false peak. And essentially, what we need to share are the next two things on that list, namely a large amount, a large fraction of the meaning of the terms, not just the terms, but a large fraction of their meaning, and the context in which statements about them are said. Who believed this, when it was true, and so on. RDF isn't really a solution because it only specifies a few relations, things like Dano, Oil, Al, and so on, specify a few more. What we need to do is agree on tens of thousands of relations, of predicates, of functions. If we don't, again, we're only going to be having the veneer of agreement. There is no correct upper ontology, so our apes, monkeys, our poinsettias, red flowers. If your spouse asks you to bring home those red flowers that she or he likes and you don't, and you say poinsettias aren't really red flowers, so I didn't get them for you, you're not going to have a good evening. And basically, there are ontologies in which apes are monkeys. There are ontologies in which poinsettias are red flowers. And it's important to be able to represent each of these different ontological commitments, even though in some sense some of them are technically or scientifically wrong. It doesn't matter. All that that means is you have to not dump them all into one single flat ontology. And same thing is true of do you want Davidsonian or non-Davidsonian representation for events, especially because events are rich. Neither one of these is, so to speak, the right way to represent a wedding. Neither one of them is wrong. You really want to be able to have both representations. A lot of tools out there are doing social network analysis and recognizing patterns in ontologies. And again, if you don't have the ability to transform from one kind of representation to another, you're going to miss some of those patterns. So when I say we don't need separate ontologies, what I mean is that we can use an IST predicate to basically have separate contexts and to just assert something is true in some context. In one context, apes are monkeys. In another context, poinsettias are red flowers. In another context, they're not, and so on. The contexts themselves, or microtheories, can be considered first-class objects. They can organize into hierarchies using relations like general NT, and so on. We've identified about a dozen dimensions or facets of ontology space, which I don't really have time to go into, so I'm just going to go skip through them. But you can look at the that if you want. The system itself needs to be able to do the reasoning to decide things like if P is true in one context and P implies Q is true in another context, exactly what context can you infer Q? That's much more complicated than you might think, and there actually are different calculi, dimension for dimension, for deciding what the answer to that question is. So basically the idea is here that we can have declarative assertions in our knowledge base that map terms from one microtheory into terms of another microtheory. We can have some of the microtheories have the names of some well-known ontologies. We've done that in Psych, for example, and we've actually mapped a large number of ontologies over the years into alignment with Psych, and thereby, using Psych as a kind of interlingua, into each other. So we can basically convert from any of these into any of the other ones of these, because all of them are aligned with Psych. The way we do that is we have predicates like synonymous external concept that essentially let us say in this or that or the other ontology, something that in WordNet is this syn set is the concept concerto in Psych, and so on. We have overlapping external concept if there's not a perfect match, and we have an actual explicit code mapping in the case of database schemas or more complicated sort of field decodings like this MGA database, where the referent of the row of a certain table, one of its fields, the population field, is the number of inhabitants, what Psych would call the number of inhabitants of that geopolitical region. Okay, so basically I'm out of time, as I sort of was afraid I would be, so I don't really have time to say anything at all about OpenPsych and OpenCertPsych. So ask me about them later.
Okay, thanks, Doug. Adam, are you still on?
Adam, are you still on the phone?
I am, and so if you bring up my slides, let me know, and so I'll get
okay.
Settings
of the all right.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
This is Barry. I sent you, and you sent the slides by email if you have time to put them up before the session starts in a few minutes.
Okay, great. Peter, we will do that. Okay. So
Adams. Okay, Adam.
Okay, moving immediately on to slide two, which is a slide that Steve Ray introduced me to quite a while ago about different styles of data standards. For this group, I'll just move quickly through this. I mean, I think what we're really looking for are semantic models being standards of the first thing, old style, which are English words and definitions, not even data model standards, which have some minimal amount of structure, but no real meaning. We're looking for standards that actually mean slide three, to hammer this home. And forgive me for some issues, this is obvious, but others hopefully this will crystallize things a little bit. Imagine your view of the web where you see the stuff in white, and you can make the interpretation that's given here in red because of your knowledge of people's names and education and so forth. Slide four. However, of course, what a computer sees is this meaningless collection of symbols. And so we have to be sure at all times that because we've named something, that doesn't mean it actually means anything to the computer, has any semantics whatsoever, other than semantics that are sort of developed on the basis of having a human loop and a human that you can contact as well. Because, of course, if you have to contact a human and that human is on vacation or otherwise unavailable, your stuff, your semantic interoperability doesn't exist because you've got to get this person to tell you what things actually were intended to mean, if not stated explicitly. Slide five. So, Doug alluded to the big XML push in the slide to other languages that have similar degrees of semantics. We think we mean things, we think they have meaning. Slide six, of course, what the computer sees is this meaningless collection of symbols that already have some structure. Slide seven. Okay, now we've got taxonomies. There's a tremendous amount of work to do with taxonomies. And we can see that so Joe Smith has some relation to person, some relation to mammal. The slide eight, of course, the computer again sees this meaningless collection of symbols. Well, now we've got the semantic web. Slide nine. And so we've got at least a few things that are, an instance of something else, I mean, a subclass of something else. So there's a little tiny bit of difference. Okay, so now that Joe Smith is an instance of mammal because he's an instance of person, subclass of mammal. But slide 10, the computer sees, of course, this meaningless collection of symbols. And that's going to be true for any sort of semantic representation, without some sort of answer to the symbol grounds problem that we all know about. If we get enough of these relations, if the computer can do enough of these similar inferences, well, then we've got something that, in slide 11, at least looks like real intelligence, even if it isn't. And maybe it doesn't really matter whether it is or not. As long as it behaves that way, then we've got people who have semantic interoperability. Problem, as Doug just alluded to, is that current work in ontology, for the most part, people in this virtual room accepted, of course, is that most people are creating these taxonomies and a little bit of frame-based structure. But that's just the barest, tiny introduction to a part of what we actually need for defining semantics in any sort of objective way. Slide 12. And building out the formal concept of unicorn. And in a shared ontology, it tends to have different, you know, Doug's world of language theory, one in which a unicorn exists and another in which it doesn't. So I don't think there's really any obstacles to having an ontology other than, of course, in this group, and we've got some, how we decide which one's best. Also, just a side light, I think that's being maybe a little bit disingenuous, if I may, about the value of the upper ontology. In fact, back in the mid to late 90s, when I was working closely with Doug and the Psychor folks, we did a little study that came out of work that we had done for DARPA, where we showed that on a very large test, fully one-third of the terms that were actually shown in answers for a large number of formal questions that were done as a test case, fully one-third of the terms that appeared in proofs and answers were from the upper ontology. So the upper ontology is not just a sort of airy, abstract thing. It's actually very important. It's essential. Now, I agree completely that there are several, or maybe even many, possible very very good upper ontologies that one could use. But again, we have to, I think, pick one, because otherwise we have this problem mapping, which I'll get to right now. Slide 14.
3 minutes on.
Let's see, so I started at 6:17, my mic clock is now 6:26. So I think I have 6 minutes left.
Yes, go ahead.
So a lot of people that believe that mapping is a wonderful thing, you know, I believe are looking at cases like this, where you know, we have some stuff that's defined, you know, in semantic web languages. It's really just a term hierarchy, and so here's an example of you know, event, and another ontology has another thing that's called event, another ontology of a thing that is called temporal thing. All of them have virtually no additional information, and so it's pretty easy to say, oh, these things are equivalent, and it's also very similar to what Doug talked about. All the things that we've mapped to, for the most part, if I understand all correctly, including my own core plane representation, that's quite old, were things that are just term hierarchies. And a similar thing for the sumo mapping to word net. It's pretty easy to say, oh, these two things are equivalent or subsuming, because there's not a lot there to tell you otherwise, and so you make a reasonable assumption. Slide 15, as I showed to the group, regardless of whether this is a current Dolce axiom or not, the axioms are really hard to align. Once you've got all this additional information about what things really mean, then alignment is not this sort of breezy, trivial exercise. And I guess I would ask at this point, you know, I certainly can't prove a negative. I can't prove that it's impossible to do these mappings between formal ontologies. But if it is feasible, as the proponents claim, I would ask, show us an example. You know, take process and program and half a dozen other terms in two formal ontologies, and show us how you can really get agreement. And I think that clearly, in my mind, what you'll find, it's what I've found in trying to even do this one pairwise mapping between terms, is that once you pull on one term, as it were, all of this stuff comes with it. And if you want actual alignment and not just, oh, these two things are kind of similar, if you want formal alignment in a logical sense, which is what we actually need to be able to convert statements from one ontology to another, you simply can't do it. It's not practical, because all of this additional formal content is pulled with each term. And so you need to go through each of the axioms in the formal ontologies that mention process or occurrence and show how they are actually equivalent. And of course,